Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a couple of subjects in the news. First, of course, is Libya and the shifting political sands in the Middle East as the Arab Spring claims another dictator. Veteran CIA Middle East operative Robert Baer joins us to analyze the fast and unfolding collapse of the 42-year Gaddafi regime and what kind of regime might replace it, and how this latest domino of falling dictatorships will influence events in Syria, Palestine, and Iran. Then we'll talk with the author of the groundbreaking book that unveils the secret history of our machinations and deals with oil dictatorships in the Persian Gulf, as only a few decades ago the United States suddenly moved from an oil exporter to a country increasingly dependent on Middle East oil. Andrew Scott Cooper, the author of The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East, joins us. Joining us now is Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story, came out this year. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Good to be here.
And the ground is shifting so fast in the Middle East, and particularly under Gaddafi's feet, the way that the largely Western rebels took Tripoli so fast, I think, caught everybody by surprise. What do you think is the day after scenario here, given that it looks like the Western rebels and the Berbers in particular seem to be the ones that really did the real work, and the Eastern Benghazi people are the ones that we've made all the deals with?
Well, I think it's premature to declare any sort of victory that we would accept. The country's very much divided, has been through its history, and with Gaddafi gone now, I mean, whatever his fate is, whatever power he's left, he doesn't have it anymore. That's the point. And we have a vacuum. There's no other way to describe it. The rebels are not unified. They don't have a government. There hasn't been a cabinet since the first week of August. You had General Yusuf murdered, assassinated, and there's been no conclusion on that, who did it. It was probably his own tribe, I'm hearing. But the point is, there's nobody to take reins of power in Libya right now. And as these things go, there's a chance that the Libyans can start fighting each other. I'm not saying they will, but there is a chance. You've got all these weapon stores have been looted by the mob, and any time weapons like this float around a country or beyond the borders, it's going to look a little bit like Iraq in 2004 when Saddam was removed. And you have old grudges, tribal differences, and so on. And, I mean, we don't even begin to understand a country like Libya because it's been closed off for so long. And there are no experts on Libya. And I'm not even sure the Libyans really understood their own country. And Gaddafi was a tyrant, and he's on his way out. That's pretty clear. So what do we have? I expect the worst.
Well, on the optimistic side, of course, there is, this is a victory for the universal aspiration for freedom. And at this point, everybody seems to be sharing, at least in that victory.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I think it's a wonderful thing. He's gone. I mean, he has a lot of blood on his hands. And, his longevity was never assured, and it was going to go anyhow. And supporting the rebels, there wasn't much of an option for the West, for NATO. But the point is, you've always got to consider blowback in a situation like that. That's the way the Middle East goes. This was never going to be a situation where there was going to be an easy transition, like Eastern Europe, communism to democracy. They don't have the same traditions. And that's all I'm saying. And then there's going to be a temptation, certainly going to be pressure. We're seeing it from the right for the United States to step in and stabilize the place until it does get a government. And that would worry me if I were sitting in the White House.
Well, what does seem to be happening here, though, since the Arab Spring broke out, is that how often we've been caught by surprise, how quickly events change. And it would seem already that what happened in Libya is being echoed, at least in street demonstrations in Syria, where now they're saying, now that Gaddafi's gone, you're next, Bashar.
Well, I think this is monumental. I've written a book about Iran. It was some sort of regional superpower in the because it had influence over Iraq, Syria, and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Lebanon, you have the Shia arc. Now, if this busts up because of Syria, all calculations are off, you know, are back on the table, and Iran is certainly going to be affected by this because its influence in the Arab world is going to be sliced away, especially in Lebanon, because Hezbollah can't get weapons. I mean, so anything can happen. This is all these events in the Middle East are completely unprecedented. You know, even in 67 or you know 58, all these momentous changes and the coups against the royalty are nothing like compared today. And there has never been so much optimism in the Middle East as today, or if Bashar goes down and these people will be liberated, it's just going to be a very, very uneasy transition, and it's not going to be clear-cut for many, many years.
So let's Bob Baird, try and walk through some of these changes, since you're both a specialist in the Arab Middle East as well as Iran. Already, for example, inside of the Palestinian divide with Hamas and Fatah, as you know, there was a recent incident on the Egyptian border where the Israelis retaliated, killed some Egyptian police, which infuriated the Egyptians. The calculus there is, of course, changing since the Arab Spring and since the fall of Mubarak. But apparently, the actual incident itself was precipitated by an Iranian-sponsored group inside of the Hamas territory. And now there are indications that Hamas itself is backing away from its sponsorship by Assad in Syria and Damascus and allying itself with its more natural allies, its founders, if you will, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, the street scares Tehran. I mean, Hamas is essentially the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood. And not surprisingly, they have sided with the street in Damascus, which is against the regime. It's a minority regime. These are Shia Alawites who control Syria, about 12% of the population. They've always been at odds with Sunni fundamentalists. And for Hamas, then, to side with them was almost inevitable as these things go. Now, the Islamic Jihad, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, has always had tighter operational connections to the Iranians, to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Force, the Quds Force. And right now, the Iranians would like to change the message, because it will be a catastrophe for Iran if the Alawites fall in Syria. And if they could somehow get people thinking about the Arab-Israeli conflict rather than the street demonstrations in Syria, they could save something. I mean, I don't think they will, But the fact is, these fault lines in the Middle East keep on coming back to this reset position, which is sectarian.
But it seems like the Iranians are finding a losing battle. I mean, they pumped over $6 billion to prop up the Assads. They've sent in their IRGC and the Basij to help the Syrians, the brother Maher and his thugs, suppress their own people, because they obviously had some practice at suppressing the Green Movement inside of Iran. But it seems that you would think that the constellation is ultimately allied against them. And I'm curious to know why the Israelis and the Americans, who neither of whom like the Iranian regime one bit, why are they? Have they been so cautious about Assad going down? Because
Well, I think that both Americans and the Israelis, and I'm including myself, are sort of, and everybody is that I talked in the region, is dumbfounded by these changes, and they're happening so quickly. And it's like a raging flood. You just don't know where the waters are going to go next. Who's going to survive? I mean, are the Saudis going to survive? You just don't know. But I think the Israelis and the Americans are cautious because they don't know what's going to happen in Syria. They simply cannot know whether the Muslim Brotherhood would come to power. And if it did come to power, would it be a moderate Islamic government, let's say like Turkey, or is it going to be closer to bin Laden? And that's what scares people. I mean, Tel Aviv and Washington don't want to be answering the question, who lost Syria? Look, if the Assad family doesn't know what way this is going. There's no way Washington can. I've got some contacts with the Syrians, and they are confused as well what's happening next. So Washington, Tel Aviv are too, and that's why they're sitting back, because it's unthinkable for the experts in these two capitals to predict precisely what's going to happen in Syria afterwards. That's why they're cautious. You know, Libya, we don't really care. Of course we do care, but not like Syria, because Syria is so geographically important. It's on Israel's border. It controls Lebanon to a certain extent. It's an Iranian ally. And of course, you've got the whole situation in Iraq, which, you know, weapons and the rest of it could spill across the border into Syria into some sort of conflict. And I'd be cautious, too, if I were sitting in the White House.
So there's a possibility then that the losers of the Iraq war, the Sunni bordering on Syria, will support the Brotherhood, if not already. Maliki's taken the Iranian position, hasn't he?
He's trying to create a Shia dictatorship in Baghdad. You know, I mean, it's clear he was going to do this with Iranian support and trying not to alienate the Americans at the same time. It's a difficult road to walk down, but that's what he's doing. And the Sunni, on the other hand, only see the Americans leave and they're lost. They're only 20% of the Iraqi population. So they would look at a revolution in Syria as, a rematch in the whole game. And they would clearly identify with the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria and support them.
But the one thing, though, that even though all of these chips are falling, the one thing that seems to be clear, again, I go back to this, to the affirmation of the basic human desire for freedom. And I don't understand why that should be surprising to our strategists.
Well, I mean, come on. You know, we don't press for it in Saudi Arabia. You're not seeing any contact between the State Department and the Saudi opposition. It just you'll never see it. I mean, that it truly is unthinkable, a revolution in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, we are hypocritical on that. And
sure.
Saudi Arabia is one of the most impressive states in the Middle East, but we don't talk about it.
Right, but even the other day, the Saudi king castigated the Syrians for being so brutal. Talk about the pot calling the kettle black.
Well, you should stand in Riyadh Central Square and watch the beheadings. You want to see brutality. I just don't buy that.
Sure.
It's pure hypocrisy.
Right.
We want democracy in some places. We want it in Tehran. We want it in Tripoli. But we're not going to touch that one in Riyadh.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, veteran, the CIA operations officer, the author of a number of bestsellers, and we're talking about the shifting sands in the Middle East, where everybody's being caught by surprise. Now, of course, with the fall of Gaddafi, more pressure on Assad, the different strains that are changing in terms of the Palestinian alliances and Hamas backing away from Damascus. Do you think the recent shelling of Latakia by the Syrian Navy, was that targeting Palestinian camps? Because there had been some restiveness in the Palestinian camps. At one point, the Assads used the Palestinians to cross the border and probe the Israelis, I guess as a way of reminding the Israelis that they can cause them a lot of trouble. And apparently that backfired.
Well, the Syrians wanted to spark something with Israel, hoping they would change the message. But the Palestinian camps have always been the centers of dissent in one way or another, either for secular or Islamic. And the fact that the Syrian opposition would fall back inside these camps doesn't surprise me. It happens all over the Middle East. It doesn't matter what country. Syria's a different situation from Libya. It truly is. And the Palestinians are Sunni. Again, we go back to the sectarian thing. They're Sunni, 99% of them, and they are going to side with the Sunni fundamentalists in Syria. But we simply don't know who these fundamentalists are. That goes back to the complexity of this problem. Because, you know, at the end of the day, we may be able to live with them. We live with the Turkish Muslim Brotherhood, which is the ruling party. So, I mean, why can't we do the same in Syria? I mean, so to go back to your optimism about this, maybe this is an optimistic scenario where we're not going to change these countries into being completely secular, but we shouldn't immediately think of Islam as the enemy.
Well, I was just curious, though, about that old, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and then you turn that on around vis-a-vis the fact that the very noxious regime in Tehran is desperately trying to hold on to prop up the Assads, and we're opposed to the Iranians, and I'm just trying to figure out why we're not making some kind of choice there. And which is is the uncertainty of the Muslim Brotherhood worse than the certainty of IRGC?
Well, Tehran is the far enemy. At the end of the day, the Israelis aren't really truly worried about Iran's strategic weapons. The smart ones aren't. What they're worried about is their neighbors going over the edge, and that would be Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, where you've got sectarian warfare, some radical wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Egyptians incapable of controlling their border, as we saw in the Eilat attack on the road, because they depended upon these regimes, military dictatorships, to keep control of the border. Now, if those powers lose control of the border, the Israelis are going to pay. You're going to have rockets coming across, and they're going to be going back the other way, and people, rather than worrying about national interests, are going to be yelling Allahu Akbar, because they remember, the Palestinians and the whole idea of the Muslim Brotherhood is built around the rights of the Palestinians in Egypt and Syria. That's where it all started. I mean, that's how the Muslim Brotherhood, when it fought in the 40s against Zionists, really got their wind as an anti-colonial, anti-Israeli power. And I think the Israelis are worried about that this will come back to the Palestinians and especially affect Gaza.
Well, the fact that the Iranians provoked this incident through their surrogates inside of the Gaza would indicate that that the Iranians see this as a good strategy, and they must think that is a fault line that's there to be exploited.
Yeah, it's a I think it's more than that. It's a provocation. I think they're more worried than anything of where this is going. And especially, you have to consider, if it succeeds in Syria and it succeeds in other countries, why not Tehran? And that something was unthinkable 2 or 3 years ago about the street rising against the regime in Tehran will come back again, and it could succeed this time. So again, going back to this could be a good thing, but again, it's the question mark. Anybody who tries to predict the Middle East is going to be wrong more than 50% of the time.
Well, on that note, I thank you for joining us here, Robert Baer.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Andrew Scott Cooper about his book, The Oil Kings. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Andrew Scott Cooper, whose new book is The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Scott Cooper.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, we're speaking at a time where tectonic shifts are taking place in the Middle East and North Africa and the Arab world in general. And just to touch on the story of the moment, Libya, it's pretty hard not to assume that it's somewhere in the geopolitical mix with what's happening there, oil plays a role.
Yes, I believe that it does play a role. I've been reminded of a comment that the Shah made to Kissinger in May of 1975 when the Shah went to the White House to meet President Ford for the first time, and he said, Gaddafi is a nut, and he's causing real problems. And I don't think anything changed from that time until now, 2011. You've got this sort of interesting cast of characters. But Libyan oil is very valuable to the southern European countries, especially to Italy, Spain, Portugal, and France, because it's low in sulfur. And that means that it's very clean oil to burn in terms of and easier to convert into gasoline. So Libyan oil is quite prized. And with about 1.3 million barrels off the market since the start of the year when the fighting began, there's been a lot of concern, I think, about tightening energy markets and the possibility that oil prices will start to go up. So they need to get that oil back on, back into the system as quickly as possible.
So could there be, since so much of your new book, Andrew, is about a kind of hidden history of our relations with the Middle East, in particular the Persian Gulf, the oil kings, how the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia changed the balance of power in the Middle East. And of course, one of the main characters in the story is Henry Kissinger, who is the epitome of realpolitik and the notion that a great power acts in its interests and not necessarily according to its ideals. Is there, do you think, a realpolitik component to the Libyan intervention? Because my feeling is that probably one of the reasons why the U.S. intervened was that had they not, or had NATO not intervened, and the people in Benghazi were slaughtered as Gaddafi promised he would, he would become an international pariah, and nobody in the West could deal with him. But that wouldn't mean that the Chinese and the Russians wouldn't be too happy to get in there and make oil deals, and perhaps that's why the U.S. and yes, NATO got involved.
Yes, and I noted just this morning that the Chinese state media is reporting that the Libyan rebels have agreed to follow through on all of Gaddafi's business dealings with the Chinese, that the arrangements for oil production, everything is, all their deals are secure. And so the Chinese are now saying, well, this was you know, we have to respect the will of the Libyan people, which is ironic because, of course, they opposed the intervention from the NATO forces in the first place. But yes, I mean, we're now in an interesting situation where world energy markets have been so tight over the past few years, and they're going to only get tighter as oil production peaks. And according to the chief economist of the International Energy Agency, who gave a rather revealing interview to an Australian television interviewer, oil production peaked in 2006. Now, the IEA has never said anything close to that time limit before. They've always been talking about the period of 2020. And for them to say that oil has actually peaked, and for other researchers are now saying that oil is peaking about now, every day that goes by where you have millions of barrels out of the system and off the market, that there's always the chance that some catastrophic event or political event or an act of terrorism prices to spike. And right now, the global economy, especially in the U.S. and Western Europe, is so fragile and so vulnerable to any interruption in oil supplies that another surge in fuel costs could really be the trigger for another, possibly financial contagion involving banks and involving the debts that are outstanding from some of the countries in Europe.
Well, of course, Andrew Scott Cooper, at this point, the international financial system is teetering and at the very least in a very fragile state. The possibility let me just clarify something though that I just heard you say. Was that to suggest that peak oil happened back in 2006?
Well, that's what the chief economist of the International Energy Agency has said this year in an interview. And actually, I've posted it to my Oil Kings Facebook page because it's quite remarkable. The IEA has never said, given the timeline for when oil would peak. They've talked generally in terms of the 2020s. And then once you peak, you have a plateau period. But he's saying that oil production peaked in 2006, and this raises real concerns. And it's interesting, you know, the British government did a gaming exercise back in 2007 in which they began to look at what would happen to British commercial and security interests in a world of peak, in a world where oil production had peaked. The German, a German think tank associated with the German army has done similar, scenario in which, their predictions are quite apocalyptic, actually. It seems as though governments are just not prepared to say anything in public because of the fear of sparking some sort of reaction on the market.
So just for the benefit of the audience, peak oil means that oil is going to be, from now on, scarcer and scarcer and more expensive.
Yes, it means that the days of having plentiful oil supplies at a cheap price are more or less over. The only real chance where that could happen again is if the Saudis agree to flood the market. Now, they tried to do that. Well, they did it very effectively in 1977, as I outlay in the book. They've done it at other times, crucial times as well. They did it in the mid-1980s. They did it again in 2008, but they were a little bit late. And by flooding the market, I mean you pump more oil, you pump excess oil into the system, and you try to force prices down. Because within OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, which is the oil producers' cartel, the Saudis are regarded as the moderates, and the Iranians are regarded as price hawks with Venezuela and actually with the majority of the cartel. So we saw 8 weeks ago the Saudis say to the Iranians, we believe it's time to open up the spigots and pump more oil into the system to help relieve the pressure on the West, because of the fragile condition of economies in Europe and the U.S., which may be headed into a double dip recession. And so they're pumping now above a million barrels a day, and that's nearly 10 million barrels a day now, trying to hold prices in line or drive them down. It'll be very interesting to see if they decide to increase production still further, or whether they believe that this will be enough to offer the relief that the countries in the industrialized democracies need.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, whose new book is The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. And before we get into much of the of what you've brought to the table here, in the sense that you've sort of told the hidden history, if you will, of the U.S. involvement in the Middle East, and particularly in the Persian Gulf, and the role that oil plays in all of our geopolitics. Just to go back to Aramco and the formation of this, what turned out to be one of the most richest companies in the history of corporations, I guess. I suppose the reason that in the 50s, the U.S. didn't, I think oil was something like 10 cents a barrel or something ludicrous out of Saudi Arabia.
Oh, yes, very low.
In those days. The reason that we didn't use up this cheap Saudi oil then was because of the Texas lobby here at home.
Yes. Actually, Dwight Eisenhower brought an oil import quota in 1959, and very specific reason. Well, two reasons, really. One was indeed to protect the domestic U.S. oil production industry. And we should remember that until 1970, the U.S. was the world's biggest oil producer. It's something we forget now because the U.S. is so dependent on imported oil. The second reason is that the Eisenhower administration was worried that if oil imports into the United States increased and there were no restrictions, the U.S. would very quickly become too dependent on one or a couple of oil suppliers. And when Nixon lifted the import quota, scrapped them entirely in April of 1973, that's essentially what happened. Very quickly, within a period of 4 or 5 years, the United States became highly dependent on Saudi Arabia and consequently highly vulnerable in the area of national security and foreign policy.
So was there any strategic thinking back in those days of let's hold on to our own strategic reserve and draw down this incredibly cheap stuff that we can get from Saudi Arabia for 10 cents a barrel?
Well, at that point, the U.S. economy was the strongest in the world, and there wasn't a demand for oil that we started to see in the early 70s. U.S. and European oil companies controlled the major oil-producing countries. They produced their oil, controlled their oil assets, I should say. And there was the consortium in Iran, for example, that was established after the 1953 coup. And that was run by a majority shareholding of U.S. corporations. And they were able to tell the Iranian government how much oil they would produce and what price they would send it to market. And then they split the royalties with the Iranians. But the Shah never had that control over his resource. He never had that control over his revenue source that he wanted. And so you can sort of understand why in the early 70s there was this push by the Shah and actually by Gaddafi, who was the first to move, to nationalize the operations of the foreign oil consortiums.
And give birth to OPEC.
Yes, well, OPEC came about in 1960, but it really was a paper tiger until 1973. And in fact, U.S. officials were told to ignore OPEC initially. For over a decade, they were told, don't give this body the legitimacy it craves. And they preferred to deal with governments. And that was the Shah's attitude generally, too. But the Shah saw OPEC as a vehicle for him to push through the higher prices that he wanted to, in order to generate billions of dollars in more revenue, to modernize the Iranian economy, and also to turn Iran into this sort of military powerhouse that he envisioned. He had grandiose ideas of becoming the successor to Cyrus the Great. And here you see this interesting confluence between Iranian nationalism and U.S. national security, and there's always going to be a conflict there.
Well, it certainly there is at the moment.
Yes, absolutely.
And we no point in getting into it. It's too complicated. But the grounds are shifting everywhere in the Middle East, and the Iranians, of course, are terrified. The Assads are going to go down. They're losing influence over Hamas, etc. There's all kinds of behind the scenes adjustments going on as the Arab Spring catches everybody by surprise. And eventually, I think it'll also affect the Saudi regime.
Yes, and I think one thing to think about in terms of oil prices and how I think the U.S. and the Europeans would love to see oil come way down below $100 again to offer them relief on their economies. But there's one big issue and problem now, and it is related to the Saudi Spring. The Saudis' budget. And last year the Saudi budget was predicated on the fact that oil would not fall below, say, $68 a barrel. So that's how they made all their spending plans for the next year or 2 years. But with the outbreak of the Arab Spring, the Saudis are very worried about domestic instability, and they have announced lavish spending plans, over $150 billion to spend on subsidies for Saudi people to build more housing, to give every family, I think there was a $1,000 subsidy. That money has to come from somewhere, and so consequently, the latest statistics show that the Saudi budget is predicated on oil remaining at about $85 a barrel. So if they go below $85 a barrel, they're really going to be taking a big financial hit at a time when they have a lot of outstanding commitments. And just another factor that plays into this issue, too, with the Saudis, last year the Obama administration concluded a $65 billion arms deal with the Saudis. Now, this is the biggest arms deal in history. That money has to come from somewhere, and I have a feeling that that money is going to come from us. I think that taxpayers in the United States are probably going to be paying for the weapons that their government is selling to the Saudis, because the Saudis can't afford to take too big a hit now financially.
And that would come as a surprise to a lot of people, but nevertheless, I'm speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, whose new book is The Oil Kings, How the US, Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. And this is an extraordinary examination of a kind of hidden history that Andrew Scott Cooper has brought forth in this brand new book about the US's relations with the Persian Gulf states, the oil-producing states of the Middle East, and to a lesser extent North Africa, and how our dependence on foreign oil has grown over the years, and particularly as is our relationship with Saudi Arabia. Let's go to the key kind of turning point, if you will, where much of your story begins, Andrew, and that is, of course, the 1973 October Yom Kippur War, where apparently Nixon had told the Saudis that the U.S. was remaining neutral, but was secretly resupplying Israel. And then apparently some of the planes couldn't, had problems landing in the Azores or something. And then in the long and short it was, the Saudis got, probably from the Russians, got satellite pictures of all these American transport planes on Israeli airfields. And the Saudi king was so angry, he just turned off the tap. And thus we had the first oil shock.
Yes, King Faisal of Saudi Arabia had been pleading with the Nixon administration for months, well in advance of the outbreak of the war, saying, we need U.S. engagement in the Middle East peace process now, because I can't restrain the radicals, not only the radicals within Saudi Arabia, but also the Arab governments at that moment were radicalizing. Gaddafi was a big part of that. And Faisal feared that if he did not keep up with the radicals, he would lose his throne. And he was trying to get the U.S. to take a more even-handed approach in the Middle East. Kissinger disregarded those warnings and shrugged them off. And the U.S. officials believed that the Saudis were so weak militarily and so dependent on them for military supplies, they would never challenge the United States in such a public way. And we now have transcripts, I think, that show just hours before Faisal imposing the oil embargo, which we have to think of as a declaration of warfare, against the transcript showed Kissinger in a White House meeting, they're having an emergency meeting with other administration officials, and they're saying, you know, essentially, my God, you know, what is it going to happen now? Are we going to have an oil embargo? And what might happen? And Kissinger's saying, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. The Saudis are on. I've taken care of the Saudis. Nothing's going to happen. And a couple of days later, of course, the embargo was declared. And we now know also that the embargo had much more, I think, serious consequences than were understood by the public at the time. And one of those consequences was that the Saudis were responsible for, well, Saudi oil fueled the U.S. Mediterranean and Pacific fleets. Now, once that oil was cut off, there was the very real prospect that U.S. aircraft carrier battle groups would be adrift in the Mediterranean and the Pacific with no fuel, and that this would create an incentive for the Soviets to start probing in the Middle East and taking advantage. And that's in the part of the story where I detail how the oil embargo was broken, and the Shah was very important in helping the U.S. put pressure on the Saudis to at least release oil for U.S. military forces.
Well, of course, the other part of the hidden story that you've revealed is the extent to which the U.S. was also planning on military action to take Abu Dhabi and the Emirates and Kuwait and perhaps Saudi Arabia. Because years ago, I remember talking with Ambassador James Akins, former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, and he said, you know, the Saudis were coming to him and terrified, and they say, you know, we're hearing rumors that the Americans are planning on sending the Marines in and to take over our oil fields and to capture our oil. And so Akins got with his boss, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and said, what kind of crazy talk is that? Who in the hell is saying this stuff? And there was this embarrassed silence on the other end of the phone. And Kissinger said, well, that's coming from me.
Yes. And I have some new information in the book on actually when Akins was fired by Kissinger and how he found out the news by reading the New York Times. The Nixon administration was prepared, we now know, in October, November of 1973 to send the Marines into the heartland, the heart of Arab oil country, to make a point to the Saudis and to the other countries that had imposed the boycott. I interviewed former Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, who did not want to really talk about this issue, but did after I presented him with some information that I had. And he conceded that, yes, they were prepared to send Marines into Abu Dhabi to make a point. It would have given them a platform in the region to use military power to project U.S. Power interests. And the Marines were being assembled offshore right through the end of November. Now, separately, there was a contingency plan that the U.S. Nixon and Ford administrations developed with the Shah. And that would be for the Shah to send Iranian paratroopers into Saudi Arabia and Kuwait in the event of a regional emergency. Now, they didn't really specify what sort of regional emergency might warrant the Iranians invading the Persian Gulf on behalf of the U.S., but they were very concerned at that time about a young, upcoming Iraqi named Saddam Hussein. And we know that in early 1973, the Iraqis sent military forces over the border into Kuwait. Now, this is 17 years before the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. So the Shah called Saddam Hussein's bluff. The Iraqis pulled their forces out. But the Shah said to Nixon and Kissinger, look, I think we need a plan to put a plan in place. And that means that if we invade Kuwait, we need your backing at the United Nations. And that backing was guaranteed.
So, again, I'm speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, whose new book is The Oil Kings, How the Iran and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. So, you know, in spite of all the complexities of this rivalry between Iran and between the Sunnis and the Shia, as we now sort of identified it, what was the logic in effect of the U.S. arming both sides as allegiances shifted? Because you've described how the Shah helped out the U.S. When the Saudis embargoed oil in 73, but then later the tables turned when the Saudis helped the U.S. break OPEC, which was being led by the Shah.
Yes, I mean, there was a big deal went down in order to get the Saudis to lift the embargo. And King Faisal held out, partly because he was, again, scared of taking any action that would alienate the Gaddafis of the Middle East. But he was also looking for a big deal, and the Saudis were very uncomfortable with the existing security arrangement, which called on Iran to be the senior partner in the Persian Gulf in terms of U.S. allies out there. So Iran was designated the senior partner to look after oil in the region. The Saudis, of course, have historically have had great problems with the Iranians, and there's that religious divide. And they were looking for a way to, I guess, normalize their relationship with Washington and put them on more of an equal footing with the Iranians. And as part of the deal to end the embargo, Kissinger and Nixon, although by the transcripts I've read, it seems as though this is more of a Kissinger plan, the U.S. would indeed raise the Saudis to the level of ally. They would arm them, and they would also help the Saudis take care of internal subversion and help them stabilize the region. And this is quite interesting because it shows a level of U.S. Involvement in internal Saudi affairs that I don't think we were quite aware of before.
Well, it just to that, to the arms issue, I mean, given the how much we did arm the Shah and give him everything he wanted, including nuclear technology and incidentally the intaglio presses that make the U.S. currency, which ended up in the hands of Hezbollah, I believe, to the tune of about $17 billion of counterfeit U.S. bills. So there's been a lot of what they call blowback from the what happened with the Shah. But we've also, you know, as your book indicates, the Oil Kings, this much of what goes on there is oil, is arms deals.
Yes.
Now, I've heard from my friend Bob Baer, who was with the CIA, that that this is also a way that the princes get money through you know, kickbacks, et cetera.
Oh, but, yes.
That's how the House of Saud, you know, pays themselves. You said the latest one we're going to pay for. What kind of strategic thinking goes on the United States' part about the idea of arming these people against ISIS? I recall Kissinger was quoted during the Iran-Iraq war as saying, it's a pity both sides can't lose.
Yes, I mean, it's about balance, and it's about making sure that one never becomes too dominant in the most strategically important region in the world. We have to remember that the oil is coming through the Strait of Hormuz, and that is 21 miles wide. It's a tiny, narrow, little channel. And if you block that channel, then the lights will go out. And so the U.S. has always had this. There's always been this tension between arming the Saudis against Iran, but then how strong do you really want the Saudis to be? Because when we armed the Iranians, the Shah got it into his head that he could actually dominate the Persian Gulf. And then he, of course, was talking about controlling airspace as far as the Sea of Japan with the huge air force he was buying from the U.S. at the time. And so, yes, I mean, there's balance of power reasons for it, but it's a cycle that just never ends because, the $65 billion arms deal with the Saudis, it wouldn't have been reached in isolation. In my book, what I wanted to do in the book is reveal how oil and arms are tied together, and I have a sense that the Saudis would definitely, and the Americans would definitely have discussed oil prices with that. And they may well have discussed, you know, we need to keep oil prices below a certain level, below us at a certain threshold, because our banks are weak, we're having instability in Europe, and we can't afford an international debt default crisis. One of the parts of the research that I like to talk about is this crisis in late 1976, because there are parallels with what's going on here in terms of weakened banks, weakened governments in southern Europe, and the possibility of high oil prices triggering some kind of debt default.
So that was in 1976 under President Gerald Ford. Let's just walk us through briefly those analogies, if you will.
Well, this was in late 1976. It was hidden from the public. The story has never been told before. And it's actually 35 years ago, exactly. I mean, we're now into that period where in the summer of 1976, Ford began talking personally, by the way. Kissinger wasn't in these meetings, which is very interesting. Ford met with envoys from the Saudi royal family, including Prince Abdullah, who is now the king of Saudi Arabia, and talked about the need to restrain oil prices. You know, after arming the Shah and lifting all restrictions on conventional arms sales to Iran in the early 1970s, by 1976, the U.S. had surrendered all leverage over him. They couldn't persuade him to do anything they didn't want to do. And when the U.S. economy in the summer of 76 appeared as though it was heading into a double dip recession and might pull the European economies down with it, and U.S. banks were dangerously overextended to debts, outstanding debt, debts held by countries like Portugal, Spain, Italy. It sounds like a familiar scenario to today. Ford and the U.S. and its officials in the administration were very anxious to stop oil prices from going up, as the Shah had promised they would at the end of 76. And so this is where they reach a deal. He reaches a deal with the Saudis. We will sell you more missiles. We will try to restrain the Israelis in Lebanon. And we will acquiesce to the Syrian occupation of Beirut. But in return, we need some help out on oil prices because the situation facing our economies is so dire.
So let's just go back a tiny bit. Let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, whose new book is The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Just to touch on what you said earlier about the 1973 oil embargo and what precipitated the Saudis to take that very bold step to turn off the spigot and to challenge the United States. And in part, they were doing it because they were afraid of Arab radicals in the neighborhood and of course, them looking like quislings and eventually their own people turning against them. Given that the Saudis have recently tried to make a deal with Israel and the Palestinians and to broker a deal, was there any talk back then? I mean, in other words, have the Saudis always understood that the Arab-Israeli situation is what radicalizes these regimes?
Yes, I think so. I think that is the case, and certainly I think the United States understands that too. It becomes such an intractable problem, and again, oil has been tied up in that problem. If we go back to 1975. You know, the Shah, it's hard to believe now, but Iran was Israel's biggest oil supplier. The Shah guaranteed oil to Israel if the Israelis would agree to a disengagement deal in the Sinai with the Egyptians. And so you have this interesting convergence of oil and national security and the peace process. The Saudis, I think, on the one hand, yes, they oppose the radicalized Arab states, or they're concerned about that radicalization. But on the other hand, they also want to put pressure, they want to use oil as a lever against the Israelis, and they do that through the United States, which is Israel's protector in the region.
So where does this, just to jump to the one of the things that I've always thought was subtext in the Iraq situation, which, as you know, we've had two wars against Iraq, and they invaded Kuwait and threatened Saudi Arabia, and that was the reason why we went in there in that first Gulf War. But since then, effectively, Iraq's oil's been off the market. I'm wondering whether there have been some new discoveries in Iraq recently, which some suggested could have greater reserves than Saudi Arabia. So when you talk about peak oil having been reached in 2006, what about the possibility that what's been going on for so long has been that one of the biggest oil suppliers in the world has been off the market?
Well, their production is back up to pre-invasion levels. They're back up to 2.5 million barrels a day, although, frankly, their production was low even before the invasion, because Iraq's oil infrastructure is just so old and requires billions of dollars to get it back, you know, where it should be. And the estimates are it'll take 20 to 30 years for Iraqi oil production to double or triple, which is where it needs to be. The problem is that the world economy is changing, and even if that oil comes in, the Chinese economy is now so huge that China has entered the world energy market in the same way that the United States did in the early 1970s. It's like someone who's quite large jumping into a very small swimming pool and sort of blowing the water out of the pool. The Chinese are just sucking the oxygen out of the air for everyone else, because of the size of their economy and with the size of their population. I'm not sure that, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there's been a lot of speculation about whether it was oil. Alan Greenspan has been very upfront and said it was about oil. Little bits and pieces of information keep coming out, and in May of this year, the Daily Telegraph, with the British newspaper, reported that a note had surfaced from the chief of MI6's private secretary to Prime Minister Blair's foreign policy advisor, in which they said, "No, there's no convincing intelligence to support the view that Iraq was behind the 9/11 attacks. Quote, the removal of Saddam remains a prize because it could give new security to oil supplies." And I think that we won't really know the truth for quite a few years, if we ever really understand or get the truth at all.
Well, during that period, the George W. Bush era, Andrew Scott Cooper, of course, President Bush famously said, we're addicted to oil. Nobody asked him a follow-up question was, well, are we fighting a drug war then in Iraq? Mm. And when you consider the strategic consequences of this enormous blunder on the part of the United States, where Iran has effectively won the Iraq war, it makes you wonder about, we were talking earlier about this constantly shifting rivalries, how the U.S. has tried to play off the Iranian Shia against the Sunni kings. There's no question that George W. Bush has been an enormous gift to Iran. Would you accept that idea?
Oh, I think that the collapse of the Saddam Hussein regime, as odious as he was, and as it was a rotten regime, in strategic terms, it created a power vacuum in the region, which the Iranians have been very happy to try and fill. Now, whether they can fill it is still an open question. I mean, even within Iraqi Shia groups in eastern Iraq, there's some resistance to falling too closely under the sway of the Iranians. But certainly the Iranians have been funneling arms and money into Iraq to support their own broader geopolitical goals. So from that perspective, the Saudis, King Fahd and the Saudi royal family warned the Bush administration that this would happen. If you take out Saddam Hussein, you're going to knock out the strongest of the secular Arab states, and that's going to create an opening for the Iranians.
And?
We're now at a situation
What did the Bush people say? I mean, you weren't there, I know.
Yes, I had a very interesting conversation during the course of my research with, I think, one of the world's foremost geopolitical strategists, and he described the build-up, the run-up to that invasion, and this is a guy who is very familiar with the region, and he said, whenever there's an international crisis, the administrations, whoever's in power, will bring in the linguists, the historians, the people who study
anthropologists,
ethnic issues, and et cetera, for the region, and they'll talk and ask questions and try and get feedback on what's going on. And he said they didn't do that in the run-up to the Iraqi invasion. They didn't do it until the summer of 2003, when everything turned to custard. And he recounted one meeting that he was in where they had a big map on the wall, and this administration briefer was describing a military action, and someone in the room said, but you can't possibly go in there because those are where the Shia are. And the person said, what are you talking about? I mean, it was really a war, I think, that was, if not fought about oil, it was certainly about ideology. This belief that the U.S. could bulldoze its way into the Middle East, put democracy, and then suddenly everything would be, that would drain the poison. That was the thinking.
Well, that was, of course, you know, if you wanted to do a broad kind of pullback and look at the forces, competing forces within U.S. foreign policy, there have been for some time since Kissinger this struggle between the Kissingerian realpolitik types and the insurgent neoconservatives, these reckless utopians versus the cynical pragmatists.
Yes, and actually that goes back to, I would argue that goes back to 1975. I was a bit surprised when I came across neocon involvement in U.S.-Iran relations in 1975, and real opposition to the Shah from the neoconservatives. We've always believed that opposition to the Shah came from the left in the United States, but in fact the real danger to the Shah came from the right, because he was not playing the game. He was pursuing his own objectives. And there was an operation in Iraq by the Iranians with the Israelis and the CIA to fund the Iraqi Kurds and mobilize them against Saddam Hussein. And this was a way of tying down the Iraqi military on the eastern frontier so they wouldn't divert troops to the western frontier, which, of course, was closer to Israel. And the Shah suddenly decided in the spring of 1975 to cut a deal with Saddam Hussein, and he turned off the operation. And there was a lot of concern in neocon circles in Washington that the Shah could no longer be trusted because he had essentially taken an action that hadn't sold out the Israelis, but it had certainly left them feeling a bit more vulnerable. And the neocons also were floating the idea of this invasion of Arab oil fields in the mid-70s, and they argued that it wouldn't be like another Vietnam because it was sand, and you can't hide in sand like you can hide in jungles. I mean, it's a sort of magical thinking. If we want things to be we think they should be, then they will be. And I think that mentality is very dangerous.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, whose new book is The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. So just in terms of the early incarnations of the neocons during Henry Kissinger's primacy, of course, he was always the number one person in their crosshairs. Who were the neocons? Was it Cheney and Rumsfeld?
Well, at that point, you had Senator Henry Jackson, Scoop Jackson,
sure,
who was a Democrat, by the way,
right,
and
right.
He wanted to run for president in 76, and he began, especially after 1973, he turned to the right. And he was the one who hired Wolfowitz and Pearl, and you had these young, very smart young men who worked under Jackson, and they were the nucleus of the neocons on Capitol Hill. And then you had Commentary magazine, which became the Neocon Journal. And they formed alliances, shifting alliances at that time, with some liberals and Democratic liberals in the Congress to block arms sales to Arab states, including the Saudis. But they also were prepared to hurt the Shah. I mean, the broader objective here is to protect Israel and the belief that Israel and the United States have a special relationship and that has to be protected at all costs.
But in terms of the people on the inside, did they have anybody else on the inside? They had to have. Was Cheney and Rumsfeld on? They were right there in there, and Henry Kissinger was no friend of either Cheney or Rumsfeld.
Certainly was not a friend of them, and Rumsfeld engineered the Halloween massacre of November 1975, which saw one of, I think, one of the greatest purgings of any White House administration in history. The Secretary of Defense, Schlesinger, was toppled. I mean, Schlesinger's not a liberal guy. He's a conservative guy. This was really a power play. But Rumsfeld and Cheney were partners in power at that time in Washington. But I'm not sure if either of them could be described as neocons at that time, but they certainly were interested in power for the United States, their own power. But also, Rumsfeld had a reaction against the Shah, like some other conservatives did at that time, in the sense that he was upset that the Shah was pursuing objectives that were hurting the American economy. And in particular, he was not he's not playing ball over oil prices. So I don't know whether he could be described as a neocon at that time. But if he saw an ability to move his objectives, then he would ally himself with whoever he could, who would help him do that.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, whose new book is The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Well, one of the things, of course, that's consistent with some of the more contemporary incidents that we're talking about, like the Iraq War, has been the failure of intelligence, which in the case, I guess, of the Iraq War, people in the intelligence community actually were trying to tell the truth, but the White House wasn't interested. They wanted to believe that that Saddam was working with al-Qaeda, etc. Back in the period that you've written about in The Oil Kings, there were, of course, warnings about the instability of Iran. And, of course, when the U.S. used the Saudis to break OPEC and the Shah, in effect, that devastated the Iranian economy and made it easy for the Khomeini and the radicals to take over. The health of the Shah was there were reports about that. Richard Helms, apparently the CIA director, failed to follow up on a crucial tip. So walk us through all the intelligence failures. We've talked about the kind of hubris of playing one side off against the other and our growing addiction to oil. But walk us through some of the intelligence failures, if you will.
Yes, I mean there's usually these international crises. I don't think it should ever be regarded as too much of a surprise. And certainly now, when we look back over the warnings that were given to the Nixon and Ford people in the early and mid 1970s, and I think these are quite explicit warnings too, coming from the CIA, which was saying that the Shah was spending too much money, his economy was dangerously overextended, there were signs of social unrest, political discontent. There were terrorist outrages at that time in Iran, and U.S. Nationals were killed during assassination attempts. One of the most interesting warnings came about in mid-1975 after two U.S. colonels were shot while driving to work in Tehran. Now, we have to remember that at this time in 75, there were about 30,000 U.S. nationals, men, women, and children, living in Iran. Americans were pouring in by the thousand each month. And the State Department and the embassy in Tehran did a security review, and Kissinger was presented with the findings, and the investigators said, there are too many Americans living in Iran. We can't possibly protect every single one of them. The Iranian government can't protect every single one of them. We're sending armored vehicles out there to escort people as they go to work and school, but it's inevitable that there's going to be a serious incident in the future. And Kissinger did not follow up on that because it would have. He was someone who believed that he was right all the time. And had he gone to the Shah and said, Your Majesty, we have too many Americans living in Iran, and we're going to have to start pulling people out, the Shah would have said, but you promised me, and Nixon promised me, that I could have as many Americans in Iran as I wanted to help me modernize my economy and train my military. And so you have these episodes, and in terms of the Shah's cancer, this is really quite astonishing, because the Shah was receiving secret treatment for his lymphoma. He was diagnosed in early 1974. By the summer of 1974, two French doctors are flying out to Tehran once a month to do blood tests and to monitor his health. Now, we now know that in the fall of 1975, somehow the U.S. ambassador found out that there were French doctors coming in. He didn't know the Shah had cancer, but he was a little worried enough to challenge the Shah and said, "I'm hearing rumors that you have cancer. Is something wrong?" And the Shah said, "No, nothing's wrong. People gossip about me all the time." Now, you'd think that Helms would have, who had been the former director of the CIA, would have put a tail on these doctors. Because as soon as they
Helms
got off the plane
was
in Paris...
Helms, by the way, Helms was the ambassador.
He was the ambassador at the time, yes.
In Tehran, yes.
In Tehran, yes. Nixon had sent him out there in early 73 to be the ambassador. All Helms had to do was put a tail on the doctors as they got off the plane in Paris, because from the airport, every Monday morning, after the flight from Tehran, they drove straight to one of the leading cancer institutes in Paris to start their work for the day. And so you have these, you have enough information there so that people should be concerned, but if the person at the top is not prepared to take action and follow up, nothing happens. And Kissinger liked to control everything. He liked to block information from sharing information with his colleagues. He wanted to make sure that if there were any secret communications or back channels to Tehran, he was the person who was managing the flow of information, and excluding even, I believe, the presidents he served, because I don't think Gerald Ford knew half of what was going on.
Well, let's turn then in the last few minutes here to the critical issue, which of course is now centerpiece today in U.S.-Iranian relations, and that is the extent to which the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps regime now in power, along with the supreme leader, the religious, the theocrats, and the besieged militia and the IRGC, pretty much run Iran, and they do seem to be determined to get a nuclear weapon. How much did the U.S. inadvertently help them back in 74? Because there were a lot of U.S. defense and intelligence officials warning the Ford White House about Nixon's decisions 2 years prior to sell reactors and technology to the Shah.
Well, publicly, the U.S. agreed to sell Iran 8 nuclear reactors in 1974-75. And this again is traced back to Nixon and Kissinger's secret dealings with the Shah in 1972. There was a crucial meeting in Tehran. Nixon agreed to sell the Shah nuclear reactors and nuclear power. The struggle was always over who would control the fuel and cycle. How would they get the fuel, and what would they do with the fuel? Would they recycle it? How would they enrich it? How would they reprocess it? And the U.S. wanted to keep control over the fuel cycle. The Shah said, "Well, if I'm such an important ally, you should trust me to handle the fuel on my own." Kissinger really didn't have too much of a stake in this game. I mean, he wanted to give the Shah whatever the Shah said he needed to get the job done. The opposition came from the Defense Department and from Secretary of Defense Schlesinger in particular, who previously had been the head of the Atomic Energy Commission in the United States. And so he had a real feel for nuclear issues, and he was very concerned, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff were very concerned, that if the Shah got control over the fuel process, he could build enough nuclear weapons. Well, actually, their estimate was 600 to 700 nuclear weapons.
Wow.
And actually, it was really the revolution and the collapse of the Iranian economy in 78, 79 that ended that program for quite a few years. But the U.S. is actually responsible for encouraging Iran to develop nuclear power, if not a nuclear bomb. And it shows how quickly the international scene can change. the Defense Department at that time was saying to the Ford White House, look, we're having concerns about stability in Iran. What happens if the Shah is removed from power? What happens? And they were using words like, what happens if a radical regime comes to power? The bomb could be the last final thing they need to complete their domination of the Persian Gulf. And I think that's the similar thinking in the Department of Defense today.
Well, just in the last minute or so here, Andrew Scott Cooper, again, the author of the new book, The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Do you think, there's so much information in this book, and it is so much an insight into a kind of alternative history that really does explain so much more than we've been able to grasp here with a very sanitized version of what's been happening. Obviously, actually, but by now, not that much shocks you. But what did you take away from this experience?
Well, I learned a lot about power, and I wanted to give my readers an understanding of how power is wielded in the real world, in order to really. In order to understand what's going on, we need information. Unfortunately, we are not going to get all the information that we need right now for quite a long time to come. But it was the understanding of how power is wielded at such a basic level. And I was surprised at the fact that oil came into almost every discussion the U.S. had with the Shah and with the Saudis in the 1970s. I expected it to be talk about the communists and the Soviet Union, because this is the Cold War period. But actually, it's about oil prices. And that goes right back to the U.S. economy and how dependent the U.S. is on imported oil. And until that addiction is broken, the U.S. is not going to be in complete control of its destiny in terms of its national security or foreign policy.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us today, Andrew Scott Cooper.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, whose new book is The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can also download podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.